Good evening. Sorry, I don't have any fancy PowerPoint productions. First of all, I'd like to thank you to the Institute for inviting me. And a disclaimer, I am by no means an expert on Central Asia. In fact, several years ago, before I wrote my first paper on this topic, I actually had to look up Central Asia on a map and figure out what countries were where. So I come to this from a very different angle. My expertise and background is the Korean Peninsula. And I was asked to come and speak today. Now, I'm actually glad that Bill Brooks went first and spoke about Japan, because I thought his presentation is very telling, because it's quite different from mine. And right off the bat, because his thesis was that that basically the region is defined by Japan's strategy, which is to which is essentially a rivalry with China for influence in the region. So in other words, Central Asia could actually just be part of fill in the blank. In other words, it could be obvious strategy for Latin America or Africa. For South Korea, this is actually quite different. And so I'm going to provide quite a different narrative with a much more sort of history, a story that is evocative, and I think a little bit less cerebral and strategic. Although, of course, South Korea's approach certainly is strategic. Now, South Korea's foreign policy has been remarkably consistent for the 60s, almost 70 years of its existence. Even though as a country, as you all can imagine, it, from its birth in 1947 to today, it's hardly recognizable. And yet its foreign policy has always been remarkably consistent and constrained by two basic geostrategic realities. The first is the continuing existential threat of North Korea, which exists still today. And the related reality, which is that this South Korea has this security alliance with the United States. So these two factors have always guided the parameters with which South Korean foreign policy could be developed and pursued. Now, within these two strictures, there actually has been some flexibility and creativity. It took South Korea a long time to branch out, obviously because for the first 30, 40 years of its existence, it was focused on internal security, internal development. But once South Korea graduated and became a member of the OECD, and its economic, social, industrial, and even democratic modernization, these successes were achieved, South Korea was able to branch out, essentially. But also, it was also due to the change in this in the structure, meaning the end of the Cold War. So South Korea began a very interesting experiment in recent decades in its foreign policy, and it has pursued a bifurcated strategy. One has been to approach so-called globalization strategy. Now, this is not new. It's been reiterated by different presidents, but basically began with Kim Il-sung at the beginning of the 1990s with this globalization strategy. And no, it is not a coincidence that this happened after the end of the Cold War. Most recently, it was articulated by President Lee Myung-bak, the predecessor to the current president, who's, by the way, somewhere downtown as we speak right now, who's visiting, his global Korea strategy. Now, interestingly, while there was this emphasis on Korea's global presence, it was also being pursued at the same time that South Korea began to focus on its backyard. Now, its backyard, of course, was a very dangerous neighborhood: Japan, North Korea, China. Its backyard was Southeast Asia. And along with its focus on its backyard was even a greater embrace of its neighborhood, or the block, as I call it, to include Central Asia. Now, interestingly, the irony about South Korea today is, this is where I should have brought a map, but you can imagine the map where the Korean Peninsula jumps off the mainland of Asia. South Korea is geographically, literally, an island today. It is not geographically connected to the mainland because of North Korea. It is essentially, North Korea itself is still isolated, but by sheer fact has actually managed to geographically isolate South Korea as well. And so there is this anomaly that's created. Now, historically, interestingly, Korea was always a great land trading nation. For thousands of years, it traded vigorously with China, with great interaction of culture. In fact, the Korean Peninsula served as the bridge to pass Asia into modern Japan. But so today, modern Korea, South Korea has paradoxically become a maritime commercial power. And in fact, an astonishing 99.9% of its trade has to be conducted by oceans, by maritime trade, because it literally cannot ship goods through the mainland because of being cut off by North Korea. Now, back to Korea's so-called experiment in Central Asia. What's very telling about this is there's a very compelling, almost emotional narrative that I think something that Japan cannot offer to Central Asia. And one of these is the experience of South Korea itself, both its history and its development in the modern world. Now, those of you who focus on Central Asia know very well the idea of the Great Game and the idea that Central Asian countries have always been dominated by neighboring great powers. And in fact, this is its existential history, and it's shaped so much of its culture, its strategies, and so on. Korea is no different. The Korean Peninsula has always been at the nexus of great power rivalries for thousands of years. And unlike Japan, the Korean Peninsula, it was known as the shrimp among whales. And so when we think about Bill Brooks's thesis that Japan and China have this great rivalry for influence in the region, Korea has always been caught in the middle. Anybody that knows Korea knows the adage, Korea is like the shrimp among whales. The idea is that when whales fight, that shrimp get caught, or essentially eaten, I guess. So Korea, much like the Central Asian countries, have always been victimized by geography. It has been geographically and strategically critical for power and influence in the region. Now, South Korea's experiment in Central Asia began in earnest in 2009 when President Lee Myung-bak announced the so-called New Asia Initiative. And the idea was he articulated a vision where South Korea can play a bridging role in the region. Now, this is very interesting because it draws in not just providing all sorts of practical bridges, meaning economic ties, capital investments, and so on. But because of Korea's history of its geographical history, and geographic victimhood, some might say, but also its more modern history of South Korea itself, where there were civil wars and the country had to reconstruct and rebuild. It had to modernize, literally from scratch, economically, and critically, a model for democratization. So the idea is that South Korea can play a role that is both active but also play a leadership role through example. Now, this policy took off in earnest in 2012, and the initiation was the 20th anniversary of diplomatic relations with South Korea and Central Asian countries. Note that this anniversary is important because it marked 20 years ago when No Taebu at the time had launched his Nordpolitik. Now, Nordpolitik was a very interesting foreign policy strategy. It was perhaps one of the most ambitious and the most bold, certainly the break with South Korean history, because it was the first time that South Korea could pursue foreign relations outside of the very strict restrictions placed by the Cold War. In other words, because of its existential battle with North Korea, South Korea always been in competition for diplomatic relations with countries that were not part of the Soviet bloc. So the end of the Cold War allowed this development, and South Korea very aggressively began to pursue relations with other countries. Now fast forward, and President Park Geun-hye comes into office, and in October 2013, she announces her Eurasia Initiative. And this is really just building on previous efforts, namely Myung-bak's effort, to expand development, cooperation in Central Asia. But she expands it a little bit, and she talks about building one continent. Now, again, the idea is to build on the same kinds of ideas that President Myung-bak was talking about building bridges, about participating in economic, social, industrial, and political organization. But note that she's talking about creating a unified system one that would incorporate transport, energy, trade networks, all sorts of cultural cooperation and exchanges. And she envisions this in an idea called the Korea Silk Road Project. By the way, there was this big fanfare, some of you might have seen this, where South Korea launched a ship to sail around. I think within a year they'll visit 15 ports, within 87 days, 15 ports and covering 23,000 miles, and it actually traces the old ancient maritime route of the Silk Road. Now, it's important to note that her idea, and actually the preceding idea of Nina Musk, these ideas to reach out to Central Asia did not and have not occurred in a vacuum. And in this context, there is this greater strategic shift in the region. And this, of course, builds exactly on what Bill Brooks was talking about this rivalry, strategic rivalry in the region. From the Korean perspective, from the South Korean perspective, Pumtunkhe's Silk Road vision. What's actually very ironic about this is it's a dream, certainly. Some might call it a fantasy. But it's purely hypothetical. And the reason, and it's an aspirational dream. And the reason it's an aspirational dream is, if you think about the map, you cannot build this because North Korea is in the way. She's talking about a geographical, physical link, linking railroads, linking roads, all the way from Busan, which is the very tip of the South Korean peninsula. And ultimately, if ever this dream were to be achieved, it would snake through China, Central Asia, all the way to Europe. And you could conceivably connect, certainly through Turkey, but even the old Orient Express. So actually, from all the way from, I guess, London to Venice, and then all the way to Busan. But again, this entire idea is based on if and only if something happens with North Korea. Right? And so, interestingly, she has actually linked this vision of South Korea expanding and its role in cooperation with Central Asia with another aspiration that she has announced called NASI, which is the Northeast Asia Peace and Cooperation Initiative. I think that's what it stands for. And this idea is to build security and peace and stability in Northeast Asia. But it's linked to her idea of the Silk Road precisely because it's an attempt to coax and pressure North Korea out of isolation. And certainly, South Korea's strategy to coax North Korea out of isolation has not worked, and along with its alliance with the United States, and also by default with Japan. But the idea is that perhaps other countries, namely, especially Russia in particular, could play a role. And in fact, Pakistan recently had a very important summit with Putin, and they talked about this idea of the Eurasia Initiative. And Putin certainly has his vision of an Iron Silk Road. I'm sure Steve Blank will talk more about this. But the idea of building a Trans-Siberian Railroad. Now, this project has been off and on for a whole host of reasons. Is again more of a fantasy than reality. But again, the idea is there, and it's set up as a marker. Certainly a goal. And the idea would be to build the railroad through, connecting the parts of Russia and into North Korea, and making Najin, which is a coastal port in North Korea, it would be a hub of commercial activity for the entire Korean peninsula. Again, this is purely an aspiration, and all of this hinges on what happens with North Korea. And clearly, North Korea acts independently of all these other strategic concerns. And so to pin an entire aspirational strategy to connect with another region based on North Korea seems a bit foolish, certainly, to me. Nevertheless, there are some short, medium, and long-term benefits aside from this aspirational dream that Korea has about connecting one continent with Central Asia. The first is obviously short-term benefits, and these are purely for economic interests. There are a great many synergies with Central Asian economies and South Korea. Central Asian economies can benefit greatly from South Korean investment. Certainly South Korea can expand markets and so on. So obviously the economic advantages are tremendous. In addition, it's the synergy of connecting sources of raw materials and natural resources as well. Now, in the medium term, again, as I mentioned earlier, part of this is an effort to draw North Korea out and to possibly constrain or restrain some of its behavior. But long term, it's about hedging. And in many ways, this is quite similar to Japan's reason for becoming involved in Central Asia. Clearly, there are questions about the role of China in the future, and giant question marks about what the role of the United States will be in Asia in the future, despite all this talk about the Asia pivot to Asia, the U.S. pivot to Asia. So, but for South Korea, again, this is not so much about rivalry with Japan, but it's about hedging to find itself in a good position, either if it remains divided, or most likely in a post-unification scenario. And in a post-unification scenario, it does change a bit Korea's relative weight, but Korea will always be the shrimp stuck between the two whales of China and Japan, and possibly also Russia, if you wanted to include Russia. So there is this question of who the hegemon will be in Asia. Now, there's no doubt which direction China's going. China's, you know, 1.1 road is very clearly an attempt to expand its influence. Now, for all host of, whole host and range of issues about why China might be pursuing this and whether it's really their specific strategy or not is almost beside the point. The reality is China, this region matters to China. And so South Korea itself right now is trying to carve out a position and a place for itself in the region, and also to make sure that it doesn't get pushed out of the region. And so finally, I will just leave you, the question that I think we all have, which is that clearly China will continue to expand its dominance and influence in the region. And the question for us is, what does all this mean? And what kind of role and what impact will that have on the future of Korea? And I think this is why Korea is so interested in expanding into Central Asia today.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here again. I'm going to start with a story. About 4 years ago, you may remember, Sino-Japanese relationship really was quite bad. I think just before Fukushima, there was an incident in the fall of 2010. Japanese Navy essentially forced some, quote, fishing boats of China out of the East China Sea. The Chinese retaliated by an economic boycott of Japan's rare earths. Rare earths are rare metals which are increasingly vital in manufacturing, particularly in high-end technologies. China reportedly has 97% of them in the world, and certainly the Japanese economy depended heavily on them and on trade with China. At that point, I was asked to come to a meeting with an official from the Ministry of International Trade and Industry here, and he asked me, do you have any ideas about alternatives, because you are voted by Russia and Central Asia? So I said to him, to the extent that Central Asia and Russia possess these rare earths, you want to try and buy them from these other producers so that the Chinese cannot wage economic warfare against you and succeed. Sure enough, not because I said so, but probably because they understood this themselves, that's what happened. This story is telling, because it tells us a great deal about both Japan and Central Asia, and Central Asia and Japan, but it also tells us something about Korea and South Korea's relationship with Central Asian devices. First of all, in this context, Central Asia is an economic and therefore political and strategic alternative for both countries, Japan and South Korea, to China and Russia. As Bill said, Japan's belief is that Central Asia is up for grabs. Obviously, it's the South Korean belief, because otherwise people would not be putting together these huge plans. It's not just the president, obviously, the staff and research institutes in Korea that are doing it. So there's a belief that Central Asia's future remains to be written. Chinese hegemony, or superiority, or whatever you want to call it, is not taken for granted. That's something we ought to understand. And it's not taken for granted by the way either. Second, Central Asia is attractive to both South Korea and Japan, because it does not wage economic warfare. It cannot, to be frank, but it does not also impose political conditions on trade. Because of its relative weakness as individual states and even as a region in world affairs, they are not in a position to dictate terms of trade to anyone, least of all potential competitors to Japan and Russia. So for Japan and South Korea, business can go ahead with many fewer restrictions on what's involved. Japanese trade with China, as we all know, and my example testifies, is subject to political constraints at any time. The same is true with Russo-Japanese relations, because, and it's true with Russia in general, because if you study Russia's foreign trade, even before Ukraine, foreign trade with its neighbors, with its partners, you'll see endless energy boycotts, breakdowns, use of the economic weapon all over the place with Russia. For example, when Turkmenistan complained about the gas prices they were getting in 2009, they blew up the pipeline and said, okay, now let's see how you can function without us. They did, because they found China. This is the third point. Central Asian foreign policies, as Fred said in his introduction, are all, greater or lesser degree, characterized by what the Kazakhs government calls multi-vectorism. Playing one side, both sides, or all three sides, all up against each other. And they all want and solicit eagerly foreign investment. Whether that investment comes as a subject for another discussion. But the point is that every Central Asian government welcomes Japan and South Korea, because also Japan and South Korea do not impose political conditions. There is nobody running around South Korea and Japan saying, you don't have human rights in Central Asia, therefore we're out to get it. Both sides need each other too much to be distracted by what are for them secondary issues. They may not be secondary issues for us here, but certainly for them, that's the case. Therefore, Central Asia is a large, relatively open, promising field of action in economics for all Asian countries, and for Russia, and even for the EU, and for the United States, if we only seize the opportunity. That means it is also a field for political and strategic action, because we live in an age of geoeconomics. Therefore, there is a large community of interest, ab initio, from the get-go, between Japan and South Korea on one end, and Korea and Central Asia. Now, in certain cases, South Korea has an advantage because there is a huge Korean diaspora in Central Asia, thanks to Joseph Stalin. And Russia is not the only country that is concerned about the welfare of its co-ethnics abroad. And second, the fact that you have this Korean diaspora in Central Asia gives South Korea an advantage, because there are people that it can work with whom they speak the same language, literally. Even if they've been outside of South Korea for decades, there is still an emotional connection and a cultural connection that facilitates economic interchange. Furthermore, these conditions allow Japan and South Korea to compete with China and Russia. As Bill pointed out, Japan recently declared that it is going to challenge China for leadership in Asia. About, I think, 2 weeks ago. And he talked about Japan having a policy of encirclement of China. Now, the last time I remember somebody trying to encircle China, and I remember this because I was born years before anybody here, is Leonid Brezhnev. You may remember in 1969, Brezhnev picked up his also collective security in Asia, which was clearly an attempt to encircle China. It failed. But again, the problem of China is such that we see new efforts to engage Central Asia, which cannot be avoided in such alliance for obvious reasons, but can be a place where Japan can enhance its influence and trading relationships. Now, there is an enormous great game going on here. I am sure that nobody in this room knows, even though it was reported publicly, that last year in November, the Russian Minister of Defense and his deputy publicly called for an alliance with China against terrorism and color revolutions. How many people knew that? Two. Yeah. That's more than the State Department and the administration, so we're ahead of the game there. The point is, China refused. But it shows the importance of Central Asia to their calculations, and therefore to Japan and South Korea. Just as Afghanistan is an object of the Indo-Pakistani rivalry, and an intense rivalry, Central Asia is an object of international rivalries across Asia, as well as its subject in its own right, each state being able to conduct its own foreign policies. Therefore, these states can respond to each other in pursuit of either a multi-vectorist kind of foreign policy that seeks balance, or that seeks to prevent hegemonic rises in Asia, particularly China. And the fact of the matter is that at least as far as economics goes, which is what Japan and South Korea are offering, and in return hope to gain as well, particularly energy. You can figure out a way to move energy to those countries, maybe by tanker, through third-party countries, which is Central Asia's landlocked, LNG or whatever. The point of this is that the economics and the strategy go together for both. And therefore, geoeconomics and geopolitics play together. Just as Central Asian states eagerly seek to avoid excessive reliance either on Russia or on China, that's why those two work against each other, they seek to do so as well by expanding their friends, trying to solicit or elicit investment and trade from Japan, South Korea, the United States, and so on. In this context, of course, the two key states are Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, the largest, perhaps most economically advanced. Turkmenistan is important because of the gas. Most of that gas is now spoken for, it's going to China. And if it goes anywhere else, it'll probably be Europe, but that's another long story in itself. But what we also see here, this will be my final point, we see four states, Russia, China, South Korea, Japan, all of them seek to create a vision of a transcontinental trading network that brings together Europe and Asia. Now, this story really begins, not now, not even in 1990 when the Soviet Union collapsed. It begins in 1875 when Great Britain takes possession of the Suez Canal and begins to build an empire in the Middle East, not just India and Southeast Asia. By virtue of its ability to link together the Commonwealth, Britain becomes immeasurably stronger and wealthier. Starting in the 1880s and 90s, for reasons having to do with Russian domestic politics, as well as with international affairs and the great game of those days, that Kipling writes about, the Russians started building the Trans-Siberian Railway. And Sergei Vitka, 125 years ago, comes up with the idea of using the Trans-Siberian, as Bobby said, to go all the way to Korea, create a colonial relationship with Korea, and link up there. Now, today, the main objective of Russia in the six-party negotiations is what we call TSR, TKR, a Trans-Siberian Railway, linking up to a Trans-Korean Railway, and similarly a pipeline out of Siberia to bring gas, and potentially oil, two pipelines maybe, into North Korea and go south to South Korea. It would have major international repercussions for the Korean problem, but again, this is Russia, what it is. We've heard about the Korean and Japanese versions of this transcontinental trade network. Finally, there is China. There are three Silk Roads. Not one. There is a maritime Silk Road from China through Southeast Asia, and one way to India and South Asia. And once you're out in South Asia, of course, in the middle of the Indian Ocean, you can keep going as far as you like. You can go to Africa, you can go up to Europe, to the Suez Canal, and so on. That's one. The second is what we always call the Silk Road, through Central Asia to Europe. The third, and it's also one that where Japan and South Korea are interested, but it goes beyond what discussion is the Arctic, which is becoming progressively open to international commerce through climate change. And therefore, they've become the center of geopolitical rivalry. All you have to do is read Russian press, and you get the feeling that, you know, Moscow believes that their armed forces are just waiting to land on the Arctic and seize Russia's precious natural resources. It's kind of got a strange little kind of predecessor that is very prevalent in Russia today. The point of this is that we are now in a situation of extreme dynamism and change throughout the Asian continent, in all the component parts of Asia, Central, South, Middle East, obviously, Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia. And as the here we are, I don't even mention the 14 years ago, so we see in Asia, states rising and falling, and elevated, two elements. States going up, states going down. Russia is going down, and it was going down even before Ukraine. And those of you who are at the Kennedy Institute today and heard about Russia and China will remember that in May, Putin agreed that the Eurasian Economic Union will be coordinated with China's Silk Road. Now, the Chinese Silk Road, specific Silk Road, the land route through Central Asia here, is turning out to be more difficult than imagined because of China's economic reverses and the enormous costs of doing this, and also because of the fact that it's a projection outward of Chinese security policy to stabilize the economy, and it's failed. That policy continues to fail for reasons beyond our discussion. Nevertheless, Russia has lost that game. The Eurasian Economic Union does not function as a union. It is not going to be a market for Russian goods, and the economic crisis that is engulfing Russia is going to make sure of that. Furthermore, the old Russian idea of what they now call the Iron Silk Road, the railroad of Korea, that's gone. If anybody builds, it's going to be South Korea, not Moscow. And it's not likely to be built. And as Putin said 15 years ago, he said in Eastern Siberia, if we don't build these networks, the Chinese will. Well, guess what? The Chinese are. It may take them much longer. It may not be as full-blown as Xi Jinping really wants it to be. But I suspect that in the fullness of time, you will see those kind of linkages. And that will open up Central Asia to a much grander globalization process than is currently in place. So finally, the point is, as Bill suggested, Central Asia is in play. Globalization dynamics, the balance of power in Asia, security dynamics in East and Central Asia are driving these regions together, and this process is not going to stop. Thank you. Thank you very much.